Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, this is part two of our live conversation with Maggie and Art. How do you like it?
Oh, I love it. First of all, Tim, happy Thanksgiving. Oh. And a happy Thanksgiving to all of our listeners. Hope everyone has a nice, safe holiday with your families. I really enjoyed the Q&A with the audience from the live show, and that's the majority of what this cut is. The questions were, it was really cool to experience people who were so familiar with the case raising their hands and asking questions and then hearing the answers. I think it settled some people's thoughts and cleared up a few things for a lot of people.
I think so too. And it was amazing every time we asked, you know, who's next, who's got a question, how many hands went up. We kept looking at each other on stage and just like being kind of shocked. We could have done a whole night of questions and answers.
Exactly. We actually went about, what, like an hour and 10 minutes over, I believe. They didn't have a show in there after, so we were able to go a little bit longer. And the questions and the people who asked the questions seemed to me like a really good cross-section of our listeners and the questions that they have, not only about the case, but about the show. So if you have questions about the show, chances are it was asked during this Q&A.
Yeah.
Or some form of it was.
Yeah. So hope you enjoy it, and I second your thought, Lance. Happy Thanksgiving to everyone out there. Happy holiday. And we will be back in a couple weeks with another episode.
And I just want to point out that this episode is brought to you commercial-free, Tim. Commercial-free from our friends over there at the Crawl Space podcast, an experience in true crime and mysteries, a better way to podcast.
Major question that I have, and I've had for a long time, and I think people in this audience and people who are listening at home and wherever probably have a similar feeling, because they want to help. You know, we want to help as much as we can, and that's why we do this podcast. We are trying to help the situation here. What can we do as a podcast to help this case? I guess that's A. And then B is, what can an individual do to help this case?
I think the first thing is, please don't go on social media if you have any information and start talking about it on social media. Because what's going to happen is somebody's going to interject something that could change the original information that you have. So, you know, we always say, please don't go on social media. Go directly to law enforcement. You can come to us. We will pass the information on. Even if you want to do it anonymously, we can do that, but we recommend that you go directly to law enforcement with that information and not go on social media and start talking about it, because we've seen a lot of
any
false
of these people that have posted on social media, one of us will immediately contact them and say, please stop talking. Are you serious about this? Please stop talking. Please get a statement. You know, I'll talk to you. I talk to them, tell them I'll record the conversation if you're okay with that. Right. Get your statement before people online start, you know, putting ideas out there and arguing. You know, some of these people shut down too. Don't put it online. Please go to somebody.
Right. It's been a battle for like 13 and a half years to dig through all of the stuff that has, you know, generated into folklore. And I said it on other podcasts, and it's like, it's annoying now, but it's my favorite thing to say.
Super annoying.
You didn't even know what I'm going to say. It was that the totality of the show is more important than the sum of the show's parts. Like, you can have all of these like sensationalized issues with it, but what it's done to advance the conversation about this case is enormous. It's gone, you know, the case is 13 and a half years old, I'd say for a little less than half that time, it's been dealing with the noise that has come out of it, that's generated from the social aspect. And in six episodes, you guys did an amazing job, like, to eliminate most of that. And now it's like these conversations that come up on social media tend to come up and go away a lot faster. because of the show and the response time. So, like you said, if you do have something and you think it's something, don't put it out. Make sure you know who you're putting it out to. There's no award. You know, no one. If you put it out there and it's on Twitter and Instagram, art's not coming to your house to give you one of those pins to say I've now deputized you.
Can I have one of those pins, by the way?
I have one of those pins.
Art's giving out these pins and his phone number.
One of the things is, I will tell you this, that law enforcement is very open. I mean, they've said to us, you know, if you've got an idea, please let us know, because we are trying and looking at everything, and they're open to anything.
Yeah, that's where the community can help, and the police read the blogs. They do. Right. They do.
They read the blogs.
Yes, they do. It's amazing what they have looked at and information that they've got to, and I'll call them up and say, hey, have you heard this? Well, oh yeah, that person just showed up at Troop F up in Haverhill and turned over all this stuff. That was, to me, very interesting. This just happened a couple weeks ago. Somebody was walking on the river right by the accident scene, less than a mile away, and found this metal container. They were walking their dog, and inside the metal container was like clothing, like very old clothing, like 15, 20 years old, a sports shirt, female clothing. So immediately I got in touch with that individual and said, you know, please take it to the state police. And they did. They showed up the next day at Troop F with the container and with the clothes. Of course, we don't know what happened with that. But it was fairly close by the accident scene.
As we shouldn't.
Right.
We shouldn't
know. We shouldn't know.
Well, unless it was Maura. We would know if it was tested positively or something
exactly.
like that. Or eventually we would know.
They would let us know that.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, it looks like we've gone an hour and 15 minutes
what?
And we should... I know, right? We should probably... Are you guys ready to field some questions?
Yeah, sure. Okay. Definitely. Yep.
So
we stole the audience mic, so you can just yell out some questions. Let's take one right here. Yes.
It's like a two-part question.
Perfect.
A family of law enforcement people. And the thing is, somebody always sees something.
Yes.
Knowingly or unknowingly.
Right.
Somebody saw whether it be Butch or the Westmans or whoever. With that said, going back to that person seeing something or whoever the people are seeing something as to, you know, she got in a car or they saw her down in the store 6 miles away.
Right.
Or whatever, like, you know, whatever it is that they saw.
So is there an account that's missing that can help the case, essentially?
Yeah, there's 7 minutes that she went missing. I mean, it's the most bizarre thing. It's like she was abducted by aliens or something. I mean, 7 minutes gone. And with two people on 911 calls. So
he did.
He drove his bus down, which was 100 yards from the accident scene, pulled his bus in, called 911.
On his home phone.
Yeah, there's no cell phone service in that area to this day. That was the
That's
time.
That's what we think probably
That's the
happened.
Puzzle piece.
And the show does a really good job of showing you pretty much exactly where, I can't believe we didn't talk about this part, exactly where she went missing. When the scent dogs track Maggie and sit down right across the street from Butch Atwood's house.
Yeah, we have an overhead shot we can probably pull up real quick.
Pull that up
real quick. Just to reference it.
So the scent dogs lose her scent at 100 yards, which puts the scent dogs at Bradley Hill. Up where it says Atwoods and Marotts. So Bradley Hill is
I forgot your laser pointer.
it's the upper right-hand corner street.
Right about here. Yeah. Right. Is where the dogs lost the
and,
track.
And not gradually lost it.
Dead stop
lost it. So that pretty much tells you a car. So, yes, it was at the point either when Butch went in to call or came back out. He went back out on his porch, was talking on the phone, went back inside, and it was during that period of time.
One of the problems we have, too, is it's 13 years. Butch Atwood passed away in 2009.
Yeah, I think so.
People, witnesses and people that have information are starting to pass away. So if you know, we're hoping that somebody will come forward here with that type of phone call to say, yes, I picked her up, or I dropped her off, or I saw her get into a
vehicle. But with people passing away, we have a few leads where someone has come forward and said, this person has passed away. Right. I feel comfortable now saying what I know. So there's advantages and disadvantages.
Yeah, there's a story out there that makes some sense to me from a logical perspective, and that story is that she was picked up by somebody around her age that she would trust to get away from the scene because she didn't want to get arrested for operating under the influence. They went to a party, and something happened at that party. That seems to be a common story that we've heard over and over again.
Yeah. Well, and that's what Renner always said. That's why he had the tandem driver theory, which does, in a way, make sense that it is someone she's at least comfortable with where there was no struggle. It was quick.
Or she just decided to get in.
There was no struggle.
It wasn't a struggle, right. Yeah. We had no signs of struggle there. Back here, we got a couple of questions.
So those Blue Mountain employees who didn't show up for work that night?
Yeah.
Yep. The Loon Mountain Three, who were mentioned in the TV show.
So legally, we couldn't say their names, but you know, they're known and they have been looked into.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this case, when you look at it in terms of how law enforcement operates, is anybody that had any connection to Maura whatsoever, whether it was through reports afterwards or contacts she had with people beforehand that they know of, have been looked into. Okay, a lot of them have been brought before a grand jury. Some of them have been polygraphed. So when you look at it from the law enforcement perspective, the hardest crime to solve is when there's no connection between the victim and the perpetrator. It's very, very hard to solve those crimes. So when I look at it, when I step back and take a look at it, that's what we might have here in this particular case, is a person that had no previous connection with Maura did something to her.
Like to, right over there. We promised that you'd get your question. Yeah.
Okay, sorry. I was like, oh, sure. So first of all, I'm not anti-law enforcement by any means, just to cover my ass here.
Yeah.
but my problem is with, honestly, just one member of law enforcement where I read the documents, and people don't understand the way the Freedom of Information Act works. Like, you don't have carte blanche to see everything they have.
Right.
So
Cecil.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, not at all. We felt completely the opposite. I mean, we spent an hour and a half with him talking to him. He's just a gentle old guy.
As I said, as a journalist, it's my job to be skeptical, and I've never been this like gung-ho, rah-rah police person. There are some not great officers out there, so I'm with you. But when I met him, I didn't get that impression. You know, I didn't. And, you know,
very,
you don't have to take my word for that. Yeah. But when I sat there,
he was nervous.
He came off very nervous. He was nervous.
He was afraid he wouldn't remember something.
And you have to keep in mind that this is also the officer that arrested his superior. And so, I mean, to question, that's kind of where because I, you know, that suspicion was in my head as well, but that's sort of where it ends for me. I mean, this isn't a shady guy. This is someone in a police force of four had the balls to arrest his superior.
Like, yeah.
I don't think he's covering up a murder now. You know?
What about right here in front?
Yes. Do you know, did Cecil Smith in the SUV have a dash cam?
Dash cam video.
No, it's 2004 now.
Yeah.
Yeah, Franconia Police was a larger police force. No, they didn't. Now, there are 7 photos that he took of the crash scene, okay? They would not release those to us, but they had told me that there's nothing in there that points to anything untoward.
When you were talking to him, did he remember how what route he took to get?
Yes.
Was he on Swiftwater Road?
He started there, but he cut down that side road because we actually did the same thing. And it was easier to ride on, 10 times easier.
Because the other one is potholes and it's bumpy.
And came back up. Yeah.
Oh, okay, so he went down like Cemetery Road.
Yes, I think it was.
Cemetery Road,
that might be
yeah.
The one,
what was
yeah.
The other one? There was something
French
Hill
Pond
road,
road
or something.
Right.
And then there's Sawyer Hill.
Right. I think he went down one of those and came back up. And that's why Karen...
So it is likely that Karen...
Yes. Did see the same vehicle.
If he came down 302, then it would raise the question about...
Right.
You know, Karen and his story not meshing.
And it was actually incredible that they matched perfectly.
Right.
He said, perfectly. Yes, I remember that route. I took it because it makes sense. It was quicker. I was speeding. Of course, she would have seen me two times.
Yeah.
So when the 746 was probably, I got out of the car, went to the west.
Yes.
And then I checked.
Then he called.
Yes. Yeah.
Right
because
here.
They immediately dispatched fire and rescue, as they always do in every accident. Yeah.
Yeah. Has there been, and it felt like it kind of like fizzled out a little bit. Has there been any like update about
the question is about the bloody knife that Lawrence Moulton gave to Fred Murray, implicating his brother in the crime. His brother, of course, Claude, lived in the A-frame house at the time.
Yeah, the A-frame house is very interesting. I will say this. I asked the state police if they tested the carpet samples and the knife, and they said, we tested every single thing that was sent to us.
And that actually
was on record, though. That was, didn't make it in the show, but we asked Strelzin that immediately. We asked him about the knife and the carpet samples, and he said, everything that was sent to us, we tested.
Yeah.
And the show also does take a little liberties with the bloody knife, and they show this knife that's literally dripping blood.
Okay, my stepmom was watching it and thought that was the real knife. I'm like, what do you think that
for all we know, Larry had a problem with Claude and was like, he took a steak knife out of the drawer and gave it to, you know, and said, I think my brother has something to do. For all we know.
It was previously dubbed the Rusty Knife, and now it's kind of become the Bloody Knife.
It's the Bloody Rusty Hatchet.
Because of the TV show.
Yeah, no.
They said they tested
everything that was shipped to them. Yeah.
Pretty sure it was a chain.
They even made a point of, regardless of chain of custody, it was tested.
Right.
So.
Right here.
How much evidence did you? How much time did you spend on the suicide theory? I know Fred had mentioned. Squad.
Squad.
Have you had any conversations off the record with law enforcement regarding her medical record? Was she being treated for alcohol dependency or depression or?
There's. I won't be. I can tell you
a lot of things were blown out of proportion, that was way under proportion.
Yeah,
that
really.
Was an extreme. Day.
Of the one thing I wanted to have a lot more film on was how horrible that hike was. From the perspective of the medical stuff, we couldn't find anything, nor could the state police find anything in her records that indicated any type of psychological issue. I think the squaw walk thing, did it make it in the show? What Fred
I don't remember,
said
but
us?
Fred said he regrets saying that.
Yeah.
He did. He admits he said it, and he regrets that did make it? Okay.
Okay.
Yeah,
right.
So he regrets saying that, for sure.
He did.
But we looked into the idea, but then again, it comes back to where's the body?
There was actually, Fred had actually had a private investigator work for him. He was a guy from Cape Cod who was a former police officer who hired a couple of people, one of them being a retired Mass State Trooper who was an accident reconstruction expert that had some very interesting information in the report. But he also had a psychologist look at the suicide theory, and they came to the conclusion that she just didn't fit the profile as to someone that would commit suicide. Now, does that mean that she, you know, maybe died of exposure just walking into the woods and hiding? That's a possibility, but...
But
you know,
pretty much ruled out with the tracker Todd from episode 5 when he said how many hundreds and he's only two of them.
Two of them, yeah.
And one of them's Maura Murray. That
he
has
was
not
good.
Been
the
found
search the search was absolutely phenomenal.
You've been dying to ask a question.
I kind of all of this, right? So on top of the semi awkward but very genuine and sweet interview with Sussile,
That's a new one. That's good.
He's sessile from now on.
I'll answer the second one, and Art can take the first one.
Yeah.
I give him the hard one. The second one, were the numbers correlated? We asked that, and that did not make it in the show, that I remember correctly. It was the numbers were correlated by year, what they said. It was not by the police vehicle 001 and, you know, the lieutenant vehicle 002. They said it was by year. So they said the SUV was 001. It was not Cecil's vehicle all the time.
It was a 2001.
It was a 2001. The other one was a 2002, and the vehicle numbers went like that. That is what we were told.
And they didn't assign vehicles to anybody.
To the chief or to anybody. So they shared it, and the explanation was he was in the vehicle that night because it was a snowy night, it was winter, of course he would take the 4x4 Explorer. So that was the answer that we got that right. Did not make it in the show.
And to answer the first part of that question.
Which, you can take the first one.
Yeah, or you can try, or I mean, we don't know, I think is the official answer. I've asked him, and we never really got a straight answer.
Yeah, I don't know. That's why I'm not on social media. Because you can get wrapped up in that stuff. And again, I know I've said it a couple times, but does it actually get us back to what happened tomorrow? Or does somebody have another agenda out there that they're trying to pursue?
We have time for a couple more.
Melissa.
Okay. Let's do guy in blue and then, okay. We'll, and then Melissa.
One of the things that intrigues me. I've done a lot of impulsive trips up to that area.
Yeah.
In Upper Boston. And so it's not out of the realm of why she did it, but one of the things that has always intrigued me is the impulsive nature of not getting a hotel room. And there's no one ever, there's not, and she clearly looked because she
yes.
made some phone calls. And nobody really, I never see much of investigation about that because I've made, as I said, a lot of impulsive trips up to that area. And I'm a guy, and I would never go up there without.
Yeah.
So, being that she was familiar with the area, like I was growing up, it would be incomprehensible to me that she wouldn't have a whole place to stay. So that either tells me she was meeting somebody she was secretly talking to, or
that's a possibility. Yeah.
And I'm dating myself with the days of AOL online. You like talk to people.
She was, I believe, it was Yahoo IMing.
Yeah. So has that been looked at?
Yes.
Yes.
Actually, when we started the show, one of the first things they did, and Fred Murray had called me, was the state police actually asked Fred if it's okay if they relook at his daughter's computer. They wanted permission with the new software that they have, forensic software, to look to see what was going on.
And she could have met with some, we don't know anymore about that, but she could have met with somebody, or as you know, there are hotels in the Lincoln area. She could have walked into one. She could have walked into one to walk in. Oh, right, ski season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's a really good point. Not a lot of people look at that she called places in Bartlett and... But she never actually reserved a place, so that's good. So what does that tell you?
We also asked Fred about this, and as familiar as she was with the east side of the White Mountains, she wasn't very familiar with the west side, but she was headed, you know, you go down 112 there, the Kankamangas, and it takes you over to the area that she was familiar with. So that's one of the mysteries here. We don't know. We were hoping to find out where she was going, and it just never...
Okay. And there we go.
Yeah. My question is more around the actual filming of your Oxygen series. And this is directed to Mackie. I know that you said several times tonight that as a journalist, you tend to be cynical, which is good. But when you were interviewing Fred, and you had to actually ask him, like, did you abuse your daughter or whatever? Yeah. How did that make you feel, like, filming that segment with her father?
How did it make you feel to ask Fred about potentially abusing Maura?
I think I always knew from the beginning it was a question I had to ask. It was something that was out there and that people talked about, and now that I've asked it, it seems like no one really talks about like the fact that that was a big thought that was out there. So, you know, just as a journalist going into it, I knew that was something I had to ask him because we had told Fred, right, we want to help you, but there are things we have to ask you that are going to be really, really hard. And yeah, he said, ask me anything.
Yeah. We prepped him. You're right. I mean,
we didn't tell him what we were going to ask.
Eight hours of interviews?
Right. Yeah. He didn't know it was coming. And that was the surprising part, is actually he says he didn't know that was out there. But it was hard. I mean, it was very uncomfortable too. And I think they probably made me look more composed than I was, but, you know, when I asked him that, it was this this moment of just like, how could you ask me that? And he did get angry, not at us, but just at the fact that this was out there and that this poor man did have to answer this question. It was terrible. I don't agree that he should have to answer that question, but I had to ask the question.
And I will say, the good thing about that moment, as uncomfortable as it was, to, I'm sure, for you and for even us to watch, the conversation about that is gone online.
Right.
I have not seen anything about that.
And that's the point, is that people forget that this was a thought that was out there. Now that it's been asked, it's gone. And that's the point. It's gone. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a very good thing. Yeah.
And Fred still likes me, so that's okay.
How about right here in the front?
Yeah, so, okay, John Smith. He seems to have this wicked chip on his shoulder with law enforcement. I know he works very closely with the Murray family. So
He did work closely with the Murray
family. Yeah. Okay. Did that rub off on them about that? You know, I just wonder. You know,
like, I think there's a weird sort of...
Does he still feel that?
And also, is that the person you were asking about? Yes.
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a weird kind of relationship there. I mean, to a certain degree, John has kept this in the public eye, and whether what he's saying is true or not, that's a different story. But he has kept it in the public eye, and I think the family does appreciate that portion of it. They might not necessarily believe everything he's talking about, but the fact that he's kept it out there and kept it going, they do appreciate. So it's kind of a unique relationship they have.
Okay, how about right there?
That's always a problem.
It's a great question.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. Okay, and I'm going to my little CNN thing here, but I was asked not that long ago to talk about the Tampa serial killer that's currently going on right now. He's killed four people now. Well, there was a case very similar to that in Phoenix a year before, where somebody had killed nine people over the period of like August of 2015 to July of 2016. And what happened was, there's a public safety issue here, and this is kind of the balance that I talked about earlier about releasing, how much information should you release. In this particular case, because there was a public safety issue, they let everything out. So what did this individual in Phoenix stopped shooting people, number one, which was good. Yep. He stopped driving his car, and he changed his appearance. So what eventually caught him was ballistics testing, tips from the public, which is the best thing in the world, tips from the public, and then some video surveillance. So, yes, that's always an issue. Can they go back and clean something up? I think, you know, with this particular case, 13 years later, possibly if they buried her somewhere, that's a possibility, but
you hit on the key point, which is how much do you let the public know?
Right.
People demand all this information and think they're entitled to the information the police have, but then you could lose your...
It's unsolved, you don't want it to be canceled.
Exactly.
Right.
Rapid fire. We got a little time for a couple more.
Yeah, rapid fire.
Everybody's still into it.
How about up there in the back with the guy with the hand? Yep.
The guy with the hand?
Yeah. The guy with the one hand.
He's got two of them.
Oh, he's got two.
Something that I wondered watching the show, what do you guys think? What did you walk?
What do we think happened is the question. I got an answer finally.
Yeah, right. Well, we went a long time not committing ourselves because a long time ago we had a police officer on the show that we had spoken to, and he gave this analogy of a case being a mansion with a lot of open doors, and you have to go through and you have to close each door, and that really like resonated with me. And we spent time in Canada with James Renner, and by the time James Renner's got an amazing way to tell you something, and you get caught in the James Renner fog, and then you come out of the fog, and you're like, wait, that doesn't really make, you know, there's no connective tissue. So we went a long time just not committing and being open to everything and mostly trying to close the doors as opposed to like opening and, you know, trying to make the narrative work. Right now, at least for me, what is the most telling thing is bloodstains that were identified in a house where cadaver dogs went bonkers. Mile away from where Maura's accident was, the people who occupied that house have a history of violence. So I'm not trying to make connective tissue, but that is where point A and point C are, you know?
And I would give a similar answer. You guys.
It's bursting at the seams right
now. Yeah, please.
No, I'm just, you got to look at probabilities, and usually, the most obvious answer, the simplest answer, is exactly what occurred. What do I think happened here? More than likely, probably, but I still have an open mind, because you got to go where the evidence takes you, is that I think somebody picked her up and something happened. Now, whether she knew that person or not, I don't know. And there's variations off that. Did somebody take her to a party? Something happened at the party? Was it just something that happened between her and another individual? And I mean, if you've been up in that area, you can hide a body pretty easily up there somewhere. I mean, it's just very
rural.
Well,
I think the key thing we're all hitting on is we all agree she was picked up by somebody. I don't think any of us think that she wandered off and committed suicide or ran away. I think we all agree she was picked up by somebody. And I think, you know, this idea of it being a young person, hey, we're going to a party. I think what I would like Web Sleuthers to do is look into those people. I think, you know, instead of going after the police at this point, I think it's really valuable to look at who could this young person, this charming person that would get Maura into a vehicle be? Where was this party? We've heard a lot about a party that happened up there. You know, the Loon 3 people, they were going by. They would have gone by that on the way to work. I think that those are where Web Sleuthers can put their resources into that would be really, really helpful.
It's in the middle. Yes.
The question about our documentary, yeah, that we began back in 2013. It is something that we're still working on, and we will release it. We have a ton of footage that we're going through, and we may even release it in parts. We're not 100% sure how this is going to happen, but it will probably happen in 2018.
I think it'll be good for the people who have asked about some of the beef that's happened.
Right, yeah.
That's what they're going to talk about.
All right.
How about right there?
Yeah.
Hi.
I feel like I remember early on in the podcast you guys mentioning this, and I haven't heard much of it since, so maybe there's a good reason, but the MapQuest directions that she had, was there an end point on the, like, are those directions where they found in the car, and was there an end point, an end destination for those?
Is the Burlington, Vermont. I believe, right?
It was directions to Burlington. But again, we don't know if that's exactly what it said. It could have just been what was released, that it might have been a location in Burlington, but it was directions to Burlington.
But as far as, you know, her going there, that isn't where she ended up on that trip, at least.
Right. Yep.
Okay, a couple more right there.
I just had a question about the investigation. Like, the police, I think, kind of put themselves under the camera, like, because they don't...
they don't come across as really very knowledgeable about anything that happens. And they really come across bad in the interviews. They really do. But could they have done anything different from the moment that they arrived on scene that could have made a difference? Did Cecil not do something that he should have? I mean, you know, as an investigator, if you show up, there's an empty car there. There was a woman there 5 minutes ago. Aren't you going to tell the state trooper, you know what, come back. We are missing a girl. You came this way. I came that way. Let's send a cruiser down that way. Okay, she's not here. Aren't you kind of going to start ringing some bells and saying that something's wrong?
They did do that. I mean, you got to remember, this is just an abandoned vehicle. I know we have the benefit of 13 years of hindsight here. And, you know, I think we did an interview with Chuck West, and the first thing he said, I wish we'd done things
they
better.
They all admit they wish they did it better, yeah. But that's with hindsight. They didn't know this was going to be a 13-year-old cold case.
Right.
They said they got abandoned, and Art has said it's very common to have abandoned vehicles, and the person is just drunk, and then they come back. I agree with you. This is a young woman.
Yeah.
And I think that was identified pretty early on. This isn't the city with a car, and she could be in the house next door.
And also, somebody had called 911 and mentioned somebody sitting in the passenger car with a cigarette. I've heard there's a few different places, and nobody goes on there. Was there?
No.
And
well,
even the Westmans didn't agree on that.
Yeah, they didn't agree on that. Issue with that. The husband thought it was somebody sitting in the car with a cell phone. With the light on.
You know what, the old flip phones? They had the red lights phone. In the back?
Yeah.
Could have been that.
Yeah. There was no other evidence to indicate anybody else was in the car. There was no cigarette butts. There was,
it was fingerprinted.
Nothing around the scene. Which part are you talking about? Because it was at a couple different locations.
Right. But I know, like, when they got pictures of the car, and I don't know if it was James Runner or somebody else who had written about it, but they were able to walk onto the compound lot and take pictures of our car.
No, they had police permission for that. I think was the Parker. Yeah.
We drove up there for a period of time. It was parked at Troop F in Concord.
Yeah.
And
Troop F in, it's by Haverhill. Troop F is, but Concord's the main.
Okay.
The state police headquarters.
Okay, I forget the town, but it's the troop, the state police Troop F. You can pull up, you can drive around the back, and her car for a period of time was sitting out there. It was not locked up. It was outside. You could go up there and touch it if you wanted to, but you were at a state police barracks. Someone would have seen you and come out. So we went inside. Then they escorted us out, and we had to stay 10 feet away from the car, and they had to make sure that what we were shooting with our cameras, the guy was right there the whole time. We asked him several questions about it, and he said that he had no idea about it. We said, what about this? And he said, I don't know. He wanted no part of answering any question.
Yeah, it did. And when we got to see the vehicle, it was in a caged lot where they had some
homicide.
Pretty other horrendous stories about vehicles in that particular lot. But we obviously were escorted by the state police also when we filmed it.
How about right up here?
Yes.
Looking online, it looked like I'm a weirdo. They close at 8 p.m., so it seems like when she passed it, it would have been open. So let's say she got in the car, or she got in the car, and they actually did drop her off. It would have been closed at that point. Has anyone looked into Swiftwater, the store, closely to see the people around that?
They didn't give us access. They didn't want anything to do. They didn't want us in.
We took the drive up.
Yeah.
Yeah. But
don't go
like,
into
like,
the
Swiftwater
store.
People have been badgering them for a decade, you know. So
they did talk to law enforcement. Law enforcement did interview people from the store, the clerk from the store. State police talked to them.
Actually, our producer went in and was just like, "Oh, hi. Do you have a payphone?" And they instantly were like, "Are you with the Maura Murray Show? We know what you want." Like, just they know.
Right.
Or call my dad or something, they have a payphone. If she got there, like, that was my instinct.
That it was closed.
That was law enforcement's instinct, too, because that's exactly where the state trooper went. He went back
That's
towards
That's why they turned around and went that way.
Now, you also got to remember, somebody had mentioned earlier, Karen McNamara drove east and didn't see anybody. Right. And she was right there.
She's adamant on not seeing.
Completely
she saw nobody.
Adamant. And you know when you go past Bradley Hill Road and you make that corner, there is like nothing else there but a rod and gun club on the left by the river and then a couple of homes. And that's it for like 11 miles till you hit Beaver Pond.
Okay, we got time for one more question, Lance.
Grimace. we're 21 minutes over, but it seems like I don't think they have a show in here after. So let's just do a couple more.
Two more.
Yeah, let's do two
okay,
more.
Okay, two more. Right up there.
Yeah, I think Fred likes saying dirt bags, doesn't he? Not
local.
He gave us a whole array of the kinds of dirt bags. Like, it was like rotating dirt bags,
floating dirt bags, driving dirt bags, walking.
There's a lot of dirt bags. We looked into that, and the police have looked into that, too.
We interviewed Lavoie. That made it in, right?
That's an extra online, yeah.
Oh, okay. We did talk to Lavoie, and of course, it's 13 years later, and God knows how many accidents he's responded to over that time frame.
We asked and it was, he didn't have the shop at the time, so... Yeah. It was.
He kept it in his personal garage.
But the
next morning, at I believe at 9:40 a.m.,
there was a search warrant.
The law enforcement, two law enforcement officers, not Cecil, two other officers came over and executed a search warrant on the vehicle itself, looking for the possibility of alcohol and operating under.
Totally. I totally hear you.
Oh, yeah.
Totally hear you.
Yeah, they all know each other up there. Yeah. Yeah.
Here's the thing, too, is we met Lavoie. Really nice guy.
Yeah.
Didn't you go snowmobiling?
Yeah, with him or something?
He took me snowmobiling, which was really funny.
With a 1963 snowmobile.
Yeah, this thing was like chugging.
Vintage.
No, but besides him being a nice guy, obviously people can put on facades. It was believable, and honestly, that's a theory that has been out there for a while, and I couldn't imagine the police not looking into that, honestly. I think that's something that has been out there. It makes sense.
And McKean were the contracted tow companies for the police force. So I get it, on the surface, if you just end that sentence with, and he kept it in his personal garage, and then it seems really weird in retrospect. But then when you just simply say, well, he was one of two that was contracted to tow cars for the police at the time, they thought that she might have.
I think that's what a lot of people are forgetting.
Just abandoned the car.
This is a police force with four officers. So small.
It was probably way
small
easier
town
for it.
Stuff, yeah. Right. He just brought it to his house, Nobody knew it was going to be like this 13 years later. So again, going back to your question, I mean, in retrospect, lots of things should have been done differently, and they all admit that.
He had to take 001 out of his personal garage in order to put her car in there.
Yeah.
Right there.
That's a joke, by the way. Please.
I know.
Thank you.
This
might
be yes or no question. In the first episode, Julie reveals that she was
Why did law enforcement never speak to Julie?
Yeah, we did ask that. I think they might have talked to her, but it wasn't like a formal sit-down, face-to-face interview.
They said they spoke to her.
Yeah, it's probably over the phone. They might have done an interview. Now, you know, you're talking two different jurisdictions. The FBI did a lot of the interviews in Massachusetts. We do know that. But they do plan on talking to her. The thing is, when they did talk to the other siblings and family members, but you know, Julie was, I'm trying to think of where Julie was at that point in time. Was she down in Fort Bragg?
She would have been at Fort Bragg.
She was at Fort Bragg.
Still stationed overseas
in Korea or something.
Yeah, so it probably was a phone interview.
Yeah. So she wasn't in the immediate area. The only information she really had that was quite interesting to us was that they were planning to go to Hilton Head, or where was it? Down in the Carolinas somewhere?
Myrtle Beach
for a concert during spring break. And they were IMing each other back and forth that.
Yeah.
Just prior to her going missing.
I think we should probably
wrap it up, or one more, Lance. Yeah, you pointed out, Lance. Right.
Who has the most important question?
Yeah, right there. You've had.
I don't have the most important.
You do now.
You had your hand up for a while, though.
Make it good.
I want to know more about the media. She just looked like she had this awful look on her face in the show. Like she had so much she wanted to say, but like maybe wasn't saying it. Like, did you guys one believe her, and then two, did you ever talk with her? Did you ever, follow up any more about, what she had to say?
Medium Allison Dubois.
Allison Dubois. yes, she. I'll tell you, the first 20 minutes, I was like, wow, she's hit on a lot of theories that we have actually sat down and discussed. And then I think, like everybody else, she might have gotten tired because we had her there for a long period of time. We did end up bringing her back. I don't know if any of that made
sense. Back to the bridges.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, we brought,
we brought her back, and we tried to follow up with taking her to several bridges in the area that you saw in different parts of the show.
Why couldn't she draw you the bridges on your head?
I don't know.
Hey, that is not the way
it
works.
That's a good question. Good question.
I go, why do we even have to ask you anything? You should know what I'm going to ask.
Just say it.
Right?
Just say it.
Yeah.
Apparently when you become a spirit, you like playing puzzle games. And
yeah.
Just say it.
The thing is, she is a very famous medium. Yeah. As you guys probably have inferred, wasn't our choice to bring on a medium. I think Art and I like to work with the facts, but people did enjoy it. It was helpful.
Yeah. It was entertaining.
It was entertaining. Did someone say it was frustrating?
No, she told us she doesn't work like that. She doesn't work like people taking her to locations, right?
She was really upset about the location
day. She would prefer to look at the picture and just... She does that writing stuff. I don't know what the heck it is. But the first 20 minutes, we looked at each other and said, wow, she's like hitting on all the theories.
She did. She hit on a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
We showed her a lineup of people, and the fact that she could separate people that we thought were persons of interest and people that were friends and family very quickly was really interesting. Yeah. We couldn't put that in because we can show faces on the TV. But
don't you think she could have heard about the case before? Absolutely.
Oh, she could have, absolutely. Yeah, I know.
Absolutely.
I agree.
But you know what was something interesting? And I don't know if she's like this... manipulative, but when she wrote Maura's name down on the paper for the first time and wasn't on camera or anything, she wrote Maura, she spelt it wrong. Yeah. And I was like, if you've been Googling this, right, but is she that manipulative to spell it wrong to get me to look at it and be like,
how did she
spell
it?
Trying to trick
how would
me.
You, how else would you spell Maura?
Yeah.
M-O-I-R-A.
Yeah.
M-O-I-R-A?
She spelled it Moira.
Oh.
Like the Irish. The Irish spelling, right?
Moira?
I don't know.
Celtic spelling.
Again, I'm a skeptic, but she did, for someone, if they're Googling this case all the time, you'd think you'd spell the name right. So, I don't know. In her defense, she spelled the name wrong.
Okay. All right. I guess that's it, everybody. All right, last question right here.
Yes.
So have you been able to investigate that a little bit more? I know that's kind of open-ended, but have you looked at some of the, is there gas stations that might have video, or is there anything that could have
The police have looked at the surrounding gas stations and have got as much video as they have. She's not on any of them. My theory always, as you know, I went to UMass and I knew that liquor store very well. And right across the street in that parking lot is a diner. And I've always thought that she left the liquor store and met somebody at that diner or got her own lunch. And that could have been the missing hour because we don't know what time she actually left. There's no clock in her car that tells us. So we know she bought the liquor at a certain time. And then from then on, we don't know until the accident.
And the vehicle was a moving junk box. I mean, the thing had a cylinder tapped out. It was smoking.
It could have broken down. We don't know.
It's surprising she even got up there during that time anyway.
Yeah, and it was in really bad shape.
We busted up the Saturn that we bought in the shop. We didn't just do the rag and the tailpipe. We busted up that Saturn and drove it. Very unsafe.
Yeah.
The fact that she was driving this up there on three cylinders
amazes
was like,
me. Yeah.
Wow.
Well, you know, speaking of that, one of the interesting things was that we found in the Parker report, which was the Mass State Police Reconstruction Expert.
The black box.
The black box. Every car has this little black box, and it tells you when the airbags deploy, when you turn the ignition key. And that black box indicated that the car had, like, gone into the ditch, and it showed a jolt on the black box. About half a second later, the airbags deployed, and then there was 7 turns of the ignition afterwards. So on that particular model, Saturn model, if you didn't take the key out and the car stalled out, it was like a dead switch. If you left the key in, it would just wouldn't turn over. So you had to take the key out, put the key back in, and she could have actually drove that vehicle away. It wasn't damaged heavily enough where she could, where it wasn't drivable. That's what Lavoie told us. And if she had just known to take the key out, put it back in, she probably could have started it up and drove away.
I really want to know the follow up from this lady over here.
Yes. Yes.
Potential connection between Brianna Maitland and Maura Murray.
We never thought there was a connection that might have been put in the show again for we're glad Brianna got mentioned too, so we're actually happy she was in the show regardless. Right. We don't think there's a connection. I don't think you guys
are
pretty.
We don't think so. Obviously, we don't know, but it's
But from listening to your podcast, it seems like they kind of know who the Brianna situation.
Yeah, there's other stuff going on with the Brianna case that I think could come to a conclusion at some point.
Yeah, it does seem like the circles that Brianna ran with probably intersected with circumstances that were from outside of town. That's at least as much as we know as from talking to the family and the investigators. And there's to try to put that with the seemingly randomness of Maura's disappearance is a bit too much. And I mean, again, we don't know. And if anything comes up, you know, you have our contact information's out there. Happy to, field any sort of theory, any detail that comes up.
And we did look at the serial killer theory early on, specifically Israel Keyes.
He still hasn't been ruled out.
Completely.
Yeah. Of Maura's case. He was ruled out publicly of Brianna's case.
He hasn't been ruled out of Maura's case.
Right. And that guy was one sick son of a bitch. I mean, the stuff he did. There's a pretty good show on ID Channel about him. Unfortunately, we can't talk to him anymore. He killed himself in jail. But
I think the FBI
is trying to go back. And what they do in serial killer cases is they go back and try to map out every single location that individual has been in their lives and then match it up with missing person cases or homicides that occurred in that area.
But he was thought to have been in the area at that time, and then he killed himself in 2012, and he never confessed to Maura, but I think he was asked about it, wasn't he?
I think he was,
He was
called New Hampshire his stomping ground.
Right.
Right, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And typically, don't serial killers typically even confess to, once they're caught, even confess to murders that they didn't commit because, hey, I'm caught, I might as well get the notoriety,
some of
notoriety.
Them do. This guy was like in a class by himself, though. This guy was out there, and actually, he never admitted to much. He was playing a game with everybody.
Right.
And then he ended up killing himself. Yeah.
All right, everybody.
Except for you.
Just let her speak. Let her speak.
The question is about the UMass cabin and the assistant track coach, Hussein. Yeah.
We couldn't talk about him on the show because he wouldn't speak with us. I had called, so unfortunately we couldn't explore that. But something I was surprised about is that's another Renner thing that Renner actually discovered. So, you know, I think there's still something to be looked at there.
Yeah, and the state police are aware of that whole scenario. And the cabin is little bit of a distance away from the
it's
exit.
In Bethlehem. Yeah, right. I want to say at least 10, 20 miles almost.
Yeah.
We had looked at when ski teams were up there.
Yes.
We looked into these things. The police are looking into it.
UMass ski team was up in that area.
We know it's being looked at, so it's a good question for sure.
All right.
And they have Laura's DNA and the familial.
They have. DNA. Yes, and if you go online and look at the Doe Network or the Namus Network,
it's on Namus. Yeah.
It'll tell you it has DNA. It also has the dental records.
So she has a full profile,
right.
And this is something we actually have talked about a lot. Is it's very possible she's a Doe somewhere,
right,
in another state? If someone took her to another state and it's just waiting to be
matched,
and
her body was discovered,
But she does have a high profile match. There's DNA and dental, so.
Right. And that they actually. Also, one of the things we suggested, this shows you how open the state police are, is I suggested to them to put out a yellow notice, which is an Interpol notice that gets out, and it goes to 190 countries, and it has all the basic information that you need, who to call. It says that her DNA and dental records are on file. And we did that because of Canada, really, the closeness of that area in case she did get up to Canada. So there's a yellow notice out there. You can actually go on the Interpol website.
Yeah.
And look up the yellow notice. It's in the public portion of the Interpol website.
And actually, something else sleuths can do, and I do this a lot too, is to look at the Doe Network and Namus and look at unidentified bodies, if you can stomach that, and look at ones that have been found and see if it does match Maura. And give yourself a little wiggle room too with height and weight and even dates, because we've found that a lot of this information is not accurate also. So that's really helpful if you find someone.
Error.
It's all manually entered, so it could be entered wrong. So, you know, if you find someone that's possibly a match, you know, it could be her.
And, who do you tell? What do you do?
Well, there's this is something we wish we could have explored a lot deeper, because we had
we
planned
really
to go
to
Washington D.C., talk to Interpol, talk to the National Crime Information Center, talk to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, talk to the Doe Network, and talk to Namus, because the Doe Network and Namus can't coordinate with all the other databases. So really, when you look at NCIC, which is what law enforcement uses, it's really a criminal database. It has people's criminal history in there. But there is a section for missing persons, and a lot of times, a lot of those fields aren't filled out. So you really have to know that I've got to go to these five different locations to look for a particular missing person.